What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world, yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? Matthew chapter 16, verse 26. This Wednesday at 9 p.m. Season 2, Episode 2, we'll be discussing legends of individuals who are said to have sold their soul to the devil in exchange for knowledge, fame, and or fortune.
Whoa. So,
what about fiddles?
Yeah.
Did you say fiddles?
Yeah.
Yeah, do you think he beat the devil? Is he included?
Are you referring to the song Devil Went Down to Georgia?
Yeah.
So, we are going to go into that. You know what? That's a great segue. So, this episode's going to be a little all over the place. To briefly take you through what happened here, I wanted to do Deals with the Devil by Musicians. Found out there aren't that many examples of those. We're going to go through some of the notable ones. I ended up putting most of my time in doing the background of Deals with the Devil and the devil's association with music and all of that. So we're going to go into that. We're going to be jumping across ages and times and citing lots of sources. It'll be pretty crazy, but hopefully it'll be some interesting stuff, interesting history and interesting legends and such. But we will learn about the connection between the devil and music. First, we'll do a little shout out. I want to shout out my manager, Kimmy, for letting me skip my last meeting of work today because I traveled today home and she could tell I was tired. That let me go take a walk and then try to put together the rest of this research, which I didn't finish in time, but we're still able to do it.
Thanks, Kimmy.
Thank you, Kimmy. How about you guys?
Well, there's a shout out. It's been a while, but a shout out to Nick from Troy.
That's Nick great. From Troy instead of from Nick to Troy?
That too.
Okay.
Other than that, no notable shout outs except to my fiance Fallon.
You know, I want to shout out if he starts listening again, David Hoy.
Oh.
No, not the devil. I would not say David Hoy is
yeah,
the devil.
Yeah, don't give him a shout out. Yeah, that's true.
But David Hoy, if you're coming back, and to my mother, who has now listened to every single episode up to this
That's
point.
Great. She's caught up.
I think besides Frank, she's the only one.
That's true. That's true. Because you guys don't listen to your own podcast.
I was there when it happened.
You guys have no idea the things I make you say with the magic of editing.
you terrible use AI. Things. Yeah. But yeah, so I'm excited to get into this. You know, they like all these people that exchange their souls for knowledge or fame, whatever. Enoch got that free of charge. So they really
That's
messed
true.
Up.
The Book of Enoch, the apocryphal book, that would be an episode unto itself.
That would be that'd be a good one.
You should do it one day.
It's not crazy enough, though. It's just it's kind of normal. As normal as a person that never died going to heaven.
I think for us, it's not that crazy. Yes, but
well, okay.
But yeah, that'd be interesting. But I think the way I'd like to frame this, I'd like to start with a question of why do we associate the devil with making deals, making wagers, right? Where does that come from? That's obviously in the zeitgeist. That's in pop culture. We see it all the time.
Oh, mate. Lots of...
it's classic, right?
Lots of supernatural... The show and shows that are also supernaturally...
Yeah, it's thoroughly... It's like thoroughly in the zeitgeist. Mm-hmm. So let me pose that question, guys. What do you think are like kind of the earliest reasons? I mean, does anything jump to mind?
Wealth? Yes.
Would you like to elaborate?
are you saying like a specific example?
Well, no, I'm saying, why do you associate it? I mean, I'm just probing to see what background knowledge you have.
Think about society. What does society want? They want money and power.
We do live in a society.
We do.
We do live in a society. They want money and power. So even today, but back then they wanted to be rulers of empires. They wanted to have riches beyond anyone's belief. And I'm sure if people still made deals with the devil today, they'd do it for fame and fortune.
Well, Aaron, some say they do it in this very day and age.
Ariana Grande.
Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift in the Taylor Swift and I said Beyonce.
I said Ariana Grande.
I think we actually all agree Ariana Grande. Yeah. I mean,
but
like unironically, but yeah.
You know where it probably stems from? Think of the earliest story.
Why don't we?
In a particular garden. And what happened? Someone was tempted because of the promises of... So I actually don't remember all the parts of Genesis, but...
Let's do it. Well, this is where I kind of lost my mind, like comparing Bible translations for...
Oh, you went all the way to... Okay.
Yes. Like comparing translations and getting like different original Greek words. It's not useful, but...
Greek?
Okay.
Frank, yes. It's a pomegranate.
Yes, good point. It was not an apple, everyone. It was not... There were no apple trees in the... Near East or Middle East, whatever. Anyway,
yeah, so Johnny Appleseed wasn't born yet.
So Nick's exactly right, right? You're both right. So if we go to the earliest, the earliest story that involves a figure that historically we associate with the devil is right from Genesis chapter 3. It's in the second creation story. I don't know if you guys know there are two creation stories, right? There's that 7-day one on the first day, blah, blah. That finishes. And then immediately after that is the actual Garden of Eden story, which just completely is a different creation story and has Adam and Eve. So people kind of conflate those two stories, but they're separate. And right in that second one with Adam and Eve, they're hanging around, right? They're told, don't eat the apple of that one tree. You could eat everything else except the apple of the tree of knowledge of good and evil and the serpent, which is interesting in the story. It's never explicitly said, this is a demon, this is the devil, this is the force of evil in the world. It's just a talking, cunning serpent. Tricks Eve, and by extension Adam, into making a sort of deal. Although God explicitly forbades them from eating of that tree, the serpent convinces them, claiming God's lying to them. And you kind of look at the deal that's offered there as, hey, disobey God, and in return, you'll receive knowledge. Don't you want knowledge?
Yeah. So,
right? Who doesn't want knowledge? Favorite. Exactly. Us intellectuals, am I right? So from the very, very beginning...
They know how to integrate.
Yes. We actually have... I have a story of a pope that would just go around doing math. And like, we'd be confusing everyone because no one... Because everyone else was using Roman numerals at the time.
He's using like the Arabic.
Yes, oh actually, God. Yes. That's he really introduced funny. Decimals to Europe. Anyway.
Oh, my.
But now we're jumping ahead. So from the very, very beginning, that serpent who historically we associate with the devil is portrayed as cunning, deceptive, and eager to make deals that lead people astray. Right? And... A little bit later on in the New Testament, right before Jesus starts his public ministry, he goes into the desert. Do you guys know what happens to him for 40 days?
He gets tempted like three times.
Yes, probably very hungry. Yes, he's tempted. Yes, indeed. He's tempted three times. What is he tempted by? He's tempted by the devil explicitly this time, who offers him, you know, bow down to me. And you will get control over this world. You'll get riches and fame and control of everything. Of course, Jesus says no. Otherwise, I don't know how history would look different if that wasn't the case. But we have those historical accounts, those biblical accounts that associate the devil with trying to corrupt people from the very beginning. It's like totally ingrained in the idea of the devil.
Because the devil's just like, you know what, Dad?
Exactly.
I think you're wrong.
Yeah. So kind of what that goes off of what Aaron said. You know, people want power or what was it? Wealth, right?
Yeah.
And what is that? That's they're envious of what they don't have, what other people have. The entire point of the story of the devil, the fallen angel, the greatest of all the angels created by God, is that he envied God.
Mm-hmm.
And so his sins that had him cast out were pride and envy. And so, yeah, you could view all of these stories as the devil preying on people's pride and envy.
Because that's his shtick. He invented that. He's the guy. He's the guy to be jealous and prideful. Pride.
Wait. Yes, exactly.
Wait a minute.
So,
no, next one.
So, pause for a sec. The devil, what does he get out of this? Just like causing chaos and like reintroducing these ideas of pride and envy that he once wanted to introduce and now,
I mean,
trying to get people.
Think about it this way. He doing it that way, it makes it makes those people stray further from God, which is exactly what he would want.
Mm.
You know?
So they'd follow him.
Not follow him, like explicitly. They're not like Satanists, but lose their faith in God. Like the loss of faith in God doesn't mean faith in the devil.
Yeah, and I'd say also the Christian understanding, and also I'd say monotheistic Abrahamic religion understanding of demons and angels and such, is that they're on another level in terms of intelligence and wisdom. They are much smarter than us. So they know how to manipulate us and sway us. And so like Nick's saying, like they know what to say to lead us astray. In lots of these stories, it's an explicit deal where it's like, you bow down to me, or you serve me, you give me your soul, which, as far as I could tell, is effectively saying, you will go to hell forever. Mm-hmm. You will die early and you will go to hell forever and you will be tormented in hell forever. But you'll be famous for a few years. You'll learn some stuff no one else knows. Like, it's that sort of thing. So sometimes it's like, oh, do this. And it's just like, I want you to be led astray. And other times it is explicitly like, give me your soul.
It's like, I want that.
Yeah. He's like, I want that. Yeah.
So won't you get that though? Like, I don't know. I'm not super in-depth analysis of like Christian teachings as you are, but,
yeah.
Couldn't you just definitely, like, wait and then get all that stuff in heaven? Like, all like, oh, I want to be famous.
Are you
just
saying,
ask God for it?
Are you saying, like, it is foolish for people to make deals with the devil?
Like, well, okay,
to get,
yes,
temporary gold for eternal punishment in hell? I would say yes, you are right. It is
okay.
It is foolish.
Yeah, but like, so then why wouldn't you just, it's like the,
yeah, saying,
the
why
kids
would, yeah.
It's like the kids, and you put a marshmallow in front of them and you say, if you don't eat it, I'll give you two later.
Okay. And would you eat it? I'd eat it. I was looking for snacks right before this. I have snacks that I'm going to have for my siblings to come over tomorrow. I almost ate all of them already.
What the?
Basically, I sold my soul to the devil. Basically.
You sold your soul to big food.
To big food. I understand what you're saying, Aaron. Like, it is kind of crazy to think that, you know, that people would make such a deal. But think of the folly of man and woman.
True. You got a point. A lot of people are pretty stupid.
Yes. a lot of people besides the three of us. Everyone outside of us and our listeners. Pretty
Agreed.
Dumb. Pretty dumb.
Agreed.
So keep that in mind, because that is definitely something that comes up. Like, it's always a very foolish, no one ever makes a deal with the devil and he goes, ha, that was smart. So there are lots of legends of later on renditions of like kind of the motif of deal with the devil that turn into a comical thing where the devil is beaten on a technicality, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In like the Middle Ages, that was a very common motif. Not the scary story, but just like puppet shows where it's like a little puppet making a deal with the devil, and the devil's like, I'm gonna have your soul. And then the puppet's like, but I worded it this way and I tricked you. And then the devil is shown as like actually stupid and like gets tricked pretty easily. But historically, it wasn't viewed that way. And those two biblical instances really paved the way for legends over the following centuries to develop. And one of the earliest stories, so we'll get into stories finally, one of the earliest stories comes from the 6th century. And this tells of Theophilus of Adana, might be Adana, which is now in southern Turkey. And in this legend of his, he had been offered the position of bishop.
So he's a holy man.
He was a holy man. But for whatever reason, he viewed himself as not worthy, and he actually gave it up. He gave the position away to another contender. Well, he comes to regret that pretty quickly, right? He's like, oh, what did I give up? Really, being a bishop, that's pretty big deal. That's like the thing to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what does he do? Well, he turns to a necromancer.
His uncle.
I mean.
My uncle, the necromancer.
Yeah, right. Yeah. He turns to a necromancer to try to get him in contact with the devil. Satan, which is, I want to go into like, never mind. I'm not going to go into the deep stuff. I'm not going to get too deep there. And the devil offers him a very enticing deal. The devil says, I'll give you your greatest desire. I'll have you return to be bishop. How he does that, I don't know. I guess you could just say the devil can sway people's minds and do whatever the heck he wants, right?
Probably.
And in return, he doesn't want that much. He just wants Theophilus to, you know, renounce Jesus and Mary in a contract signed with his own blood.
That's, you know, pretty run of the mill.
It's just legalese, you know. It's like an NDA.
That's just legalese.
So, all you know, he writes in his own blood. He accepts.
All the lawyers do that.
Yeah, write in your own blood. He accepts it and he's made bishop and he's happy for a time. And no one knows. But he is a good man at the end of the day. And over time, this does wear on him. The fact that he's made this terrible, terrible, terrible pact. And so the renditions kind of differ. But the most common telling is that he comes to regret this and goes through a very similar thing to what Jesus went through in the 40 days in the desert, fasting and performing penance. And basically, Mary visits him and he begs for forgiveness and he goes through a bunch of trials and tribulations and she's like, you're good, you're absolved. And nice. He's like, oh my goodness, that's great. And he's so happy. But the devil was not done with him. 3 days later, he woke in his home the contract written in his own blood on his chest. He ran to the local bishop, confessing and telling the story and showing the contract because he hadn't told any other person until then. And he just wanted to get rid of this. He was terrified that the devil still had a hold on him. He's like, or it seemed. He tells the bishop, and the bishop believes him and throws the contract into the fire. Evidently, permanently freeing him. You'd think he'd be fine. But poor Theophilus, bursting with joy, literally burst with joy and died on the spot. Dropped dead from the sheer joy of being freed from the contract.
Well, at least, I mean, if he was absolved and then he died, he's not going to hell. That's good.
That's true. So, you know, this, thank goodness that this one, Mary interceded for him and the bishop, they absolved him. And so, yeah, he's probably not sent to hell, but in super early renditions of this, he still goes to hell, but you know, what are you going to do? So
I got a question. So why would you, like, I understand his want to be bishop, but if you're going to make a deal with the devil, why not go all out and like go for Pope? Like,
that's a good question. I do have a story of someone who does just that.
No, boy.
But yeah, I mean, you know, he doesn't want to be a burden.
a burden.
He doesn't want to be a burden on the devil. He's like, you know, I'll ask a little favor. You know, just I'm not gonna ask for the big thing. You know, just maybe a bishop, maybe
a cardinal,
maybe.
Let's see.
That'd be huge, but
you know. No.
But he's the one making the deal. It's not like the devil's really getting much out of it. Like the devil sets the terms.
It's kind of ridiculous. So he saw him out, and he. It's like what movie? What's the old movie where the supervillain is like, "I want $1 million," and they're like,
"Austin Powers."
Austin Powers.
He's like, "Just a million?" It is kind of like that. Devil would be
it's
like
getting getting a genie's lamp and being like, I wish for like unlimited hot dogs for like a year.
That's true.
It's like, okay, well, you could have done that your whole life
in southern Turkey. Yeah, you're right. That's a very good point. Well, again, the brightest people don't make deals with the devil, right?
True.
So this legend of Theophilus, I remember thinking of Theophilus. I kept thinking of Theo, our friend Wolf's dog.
Okay.
Sounds weird. Because his name's Theo.
It's reincarnation.
Reincarnate. But isn't it also like his wolf's dog? Yeah, but whatever. So naturally, the story of Theophilus inspired lots of other ones. Now, there's a classic story of Faust, which I actually didn't get into because it's everyone knows the story of Faust. It's
everyone knows that story.
In brief, German guy, alchemist, super smart. He gets tired of all his worldly knowledge and wants more. He makes a pact with, not the devil, but one of the devil's attendants, Mephistopheles.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, Frank.
Yes. And over like that story, obviously it doesn't go well for him, right? I didn't get to the details of it, but that story has so many different endings. Usually he goes to hell. And it became just like a really common story. But did you guys know that while it was probably an apocryphal story written hundreds of years, you know, later, there actually was a historic Faust. Like there was an actual guy.
Was he an alchemist? Johann.
Yes, he was Johann George Faust, a German traveling alchemist, astrologer, magician of the German Renaissance. So you can imagine. Just a really cool guy like that existing.
I feel like that's Nick's life goals.
I mean,
I do like alchemy.
It'd be a cool resume.
Alchemist, astrologer, magician. Yeah,
forget writing engineer, programmer, economist. Astrologer,
alchemist, magician.
Let's be real. If you're still applying for jobs, and you have alchemy on your resume, you failed as an alchemist.
True.
I'll bet you five Bitcoin that I will put alchemist on a resume. I'll put alchemist on my resume. I hopefully won't need it for.
Oh, I know you will.
I will. I'll put it under skills. I'll put.
Aside before we continue, if you're like hiring someone for like at one of your companies and they had alchemist alchemy in their skills, would you just be like, we have to talk to them?
Yes. I think I'd be impressed. I'd either find it funny.
Cause they're joking.
Cause they're obviously, well,
or they're not joking. Or and then they show joking. You during the interview.
Then why did they need the job though?
Because, that's what I'm
imagine
saying.
Imagine flexing to a company and then no one believes you guys. that's a super power move.
Well, it's true.
This is, not to get on too much of a tangent.
No, please
but,
do.
there is someone I know, one of like their company was hiring someone who put Dungeon Master on their resume as a skill.
I could see it. I mean, like.
And they ended up getting the job. So.
That's pretty cool.
I mean,
I can definitely
it's a lot
see
to juggle.
How you can. You can argue that, right? I mean, you could definitely like.
Yeah, I mean, it's a stretch, but yeah.
For the soft skills, probably pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, like organization and all that.
Time management.
Is alchemy a soft skill or a hard skill?
No, it's a hard skill.
Depends on the materials you work with, no? Yeah, probably, I mean.
Good one.
So, Faust, he's real, he existed. He probably did it for real. Pretty cool. Now, a little a very cool, but unfortunately pretty dark thing. Have either of you heard of the Malleus Maleficarum?
I've heard of it before.
Translated as Hammer of Witches.
I've just heard of it, but I never read it.
We should. I feel like if I wanted to read through this and maybe do an episode on this, and I felt my sanity being sapped.
All right.
As I got it. lightly browsed through it. So Nick, you should probably take it on. I think you have better endurance in that.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, this is a horny German monk's demonology fan fiction.
I am an expert in horny German monk demonology.
Yes. And it's also, I'd say its main goal was actually a witch hunting guide.
Mm. Was this in America? If it's in Latin?
No. So this was,
or I guess Germany, the colonies. I would assume.
Yes. It was Middle Ages. It was during like the Reformation, or like around the Inquisition. During like the rough part of the Inquisition period where...
I didn't expect that.
I mean, no one,
German and Spain.
No one expects that. This guy, what the hell didn't write his name for? Oh, because I wasn't going to talk about it. Now I'm going to talk about it.
Just call him horny German monk.
I will. Okay.
HGM for short.
That's good. That's a good username. So this German Catholic clergyman, as in he was a priest, Heinrich Kramer, and he would go by his Latinized name, Henricus Institor, purchased this compendium in Germany in 1486. He purported it. He proposes like totally accepted Catholic teaching on how to find witches, you know, how to torture them to get them to admit to what they're doing, how to burn them at the stake, all of that. None of it was approved, and he was denounced many, many times. Yet still, for some reason, he remained popular, like pretty much for his entire life, or at least his entire career, even though he was condemned by the church nonstop. So this book popularized the idea of burning witches at the stake. And
so that's where we got it from.
It really comes from these guys putting it together and promulgating it. He had a co-author, which he claimed wrote it with him, but he only announced that like 40 years later, which is
weird. Wait, I thought you said he bought the book.
No, he wrote it. He wrote it. He compiled it. Yeah, he compiled it. So he popularized these ideas. As far as I can tell, he was obsessed with this lady.
She turned him down.
Yes, obviously she rejected him. He was a crazy guy.
Aren't you not supposed to have those urges if you're a monk?
If I learned anything from researching this episode, it's that the Middle Ages were pretty wacky for what clergymen got away with. It's pretty crazy. So yeah, I mean, yeah, he wasn't supposed to feel attracted to
lust.
He wasn't supposed to feel lust. So he blamed it on this woman being a witch. Obviously. He blamed his own lust and prevented his extremist violent views as the church's position. So yeah, this book, which you can just read online, popularized the idea of burning witches at the stake, and also proposed the idea that every single witch and warlock, by nature of being a witch or warlock, made a pact with a demon. Not necessarily the big guy, but a demon. And made demon babies. I glanced at I clicked on the random chapter, and it was the first line. I think I sent it to Nick late at night. I'm going to quick read it as a sort of quote of what sort of things are in that book. Quote, "There is also concerning witches who copulate with devils, much difficulty in considering the methods by which such abominations are consummated." So that's the sort of thing he was spending his time.
At least it's verbose.
It is. Yes, it is very verbose.
He did go all out.
Oh, he did. He did. He even included in the middle of the book a papal bull, which is one of those official documents that a pope writes and says, like, this is dogma. So he kind of put that in the book to show, like, look, because it talked about witchcraft being bad. And he put it in the book and made it look like the pope was rubber stamping what his book said. But it was like from a few years before. The pope had written and published it and it had nothing to do with his book. And he just put it at the start of his book. Pretty crazy. But this book paved the way for the bloody witchcraft trials of centuries later. It was, this book was kind of forgotten about, and it was rediscovered by those communities in the colonies in Europe. And they were like, oh my God, oh my God, this is what the women of our communities are doing. This is what the men of our communities are doing. This is crazy. Let's burn them at the stake. So a lot of people died probably because of this book. Pretty crazy. Pretty crazy.
And he made it all up.
And yeah, I mean, he purported it to be like a, you know, compilation of the church's understanding of demonology in the 15th century. But he definitely had some very certain feelings about different groups of people. And yeah, went all out. So we should do an episode on that one day, though it might be darker than we think, but also could probably pull out some wacky lines, wacky quotes.
Sounds like right up Nick's alley. Wacky,
what an opening stuff. I could probably craft from some of those.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, right? And this will lead me to my last sort of historic, non-music related story. I mentioned earlier a pope that had legends about demonic packs. Well, Pope Sylvester II, who was known as Gerbert of, don't know how to pronounce this, Aurillac in France. He was born of humble parents in France in around 946 AD, and immediately was noted for being real smart, like really gifted. It was clear really early on he was going to do great things. So he was sent to study at a monastery. And he had mentors there that also recognized his talent. And sends him to study modern day Spain, which at the time was nearly all Muslim ruled. But there were a few Christian kingdoms left in the north of the peninsula that kind of formed like a literally a border trying to block off the Christian Europe from Muslim Spain. But at the time, the Arabic world was much more advanced in mathematics, astronomy, a lot of the sciences. So he was sent there to kind of learn the Arabic sciences, like the decimal system.
And zero.
Well, no, they were like, he didn't pick up on the concept of zero.
No, but, well, never mind.
But everything else he picked up on, and he became very, very, very interested and impressed by the Muslim intellectual tradition that was present in Spain. He was the first person supposedly to bring the decimal system to Europe at the time, like that whole number system. He brought a bunch of different devices that let you do some sorts of astronomical calculations, but also he learned about the abacus, made his own version of it, and had it brought to Europe as well. And he popularized that. And it said that he'd walk around with his abacus doing insanely advanced calculations. Oh my God, I just hit my mic. Doing insanely advanced calculations just out loud, confusing the hell out of people. Because imagine him doing abacus math in a decimal system while people are thinking in LXVII. Right?
Yeah.
Like, I always wondered that. Like, how did people do...
What was that?
Complicated
would you just
math.
Say 57?
I think the answer was with much difficulty. Like, there was not a good way to do math. So that was pretty huge that he was a really smart guy. Well, eventually he became involved in local politics and, long story short, even made his way to become Pope. But it was at a time where the papacy and Rome was kind of controlled by other entities, other political entities. And so he was deposed and tried to get back, and lots of drama, and only was Pope for 4 years before he died. But because he was so smart and so learned, of course, legend sprung up that he had met with Arabic sorcerers and made a deal with the devil to gain his knowledge and to become Pope.
So
this guy was smart. He knew what to ask for.
But he was smart before going to Spain.
That's what I was going to say.
He was like, he didn't know about the number.
What if his parents did it?
That'd be interesting. I don't know. But he was very smart, but he needed to learn the mysterious dark Arabic sciences.
The mysterious point one.
But not zero.
Not zero.
His abacus did not have a zero. Like, I don't know. It was a little different than
What do you mean?
I know that sounds stupid.
There's just a lack of things.
There is something about him not understanding zero. Whereas the Muslim world was using zero at the time. That was just too big of a leap for his European brain at the time.
I just can't wrap my head around first how you can't understand the concept of zero.
You can't. Okay. I think it's the number zero. The number zero, not the concept of zero.
Okay. So
I don't know, like representing 10 plus zero equals 10. Like, I don't think that was a thing you could write out in any notation.
Yeah, I guess. But logically, whatever. I won't get into it.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Logically.
Well, logically, you're not adding anything to it. So I don't know. You have 10.
Yes, that's why you didn't develop an idea.
And you don't add anything.
Well, how do you represent that? How do you write 10 versus 10 plus zero? If you don't have a concept of the number of zero, there's no difference between the two, right? I don't know, man.
But what I was going to say is, I don't personally think that he necessarily met with the Arabic sorcerers.
I hope not.
To get his knowledge. But I'm not hearing a lot of evidence that says he didn't do it to get his papacy.
Yeah, he became involved in politics, and he sided with, you know, this king over that king, and he was sent to tutor the sons of, you know, this king, and that, so he was pretty good at maneuvering politically, which,
so he wasn't actually all that smart because he got into politics.
That's a good point. Certainly a limit there. But the legends about him are pretty insane. Supposedly, he learned the dark arts as well as making this deal with the devil, right? And this part is a little funky, but it's claimed that he would meet with this philosopher who would teach him everything he wanted to know, all the normal sciences, right? And eventually he read everything there was that this guy had, and he asked for more. And he knew that there was one book that, despite all of his begging, this philosopher would not give him. And it was a book on the dark arts. And eventually, now I don't know who wrote this, because they must have really had something out for him. But they claimed that after resorting to using wine and intimacy with his daughter, the Pope, well, at the time he wasn't the Pope, so Gerbert, was able to steal the book from under the philosopher's pillow at night while he slept. I don't know about that. I hope that's not true. I also don't understand, he got the philosopher drunk, slept with a daughter. Why did he have to do that? That was just on the way.
It was a side mission.
I think it was a side mission.
He needed that little bit of XP to level up before taking the book.
Honestly, I think so. And a funny little finish for this is, he fled,
yeah,
pursued by the philosopher. And the philosopher, of course, was, you know, a magician. He knew the dark arts. So he knew how to trace Gerbert. Supposedly he could trace him by looking at the stars or something, whatever. But Gerbert, being super smart, you know, knew that this was happening, and he hid by hanging underneath a wooden bridge. And because he was suspended between heaven and earth, and that in between, he was invisible to the magician, and he got away.
Whoa.
So if you ever are running from the police or something, hang off a bridge.
But careful.
Don't do that legally. We can't advise that.
Yeah, I mean, true.
I'm being told by our lawyers.
By our lawyers on the side, just getting paged. But I think my favorite legend of his, you know, learns dark arts, he makes these deals. He was supposed then to have used this knowledge he got to build a brazen head. Did we ever talk about brazen heads on this podcast?
I don't think so.
Are you familiar with them?
That is one thing I am not.
You probably would. I'm going to cut this. No, I'm not going to say that. Yeah. So yeah, this Pope Sylvester II, Gerbert, was, he reintroduced a lot of stuff that was lost to Europe after the fall of Rome, which is pretty cool. So he was supposed to have built a brazen head. I love this. Oh, I love this. You guys are going to love this. A brazen head, or I think more commonly it was called a brass head, was a legendary automaton.
Oh.
In the, I would say, think of like Renaissance era, typically the legends were about, it was always said that like wizards, or honestly, it was just super smart guys like Pope Sylvester II, like Roger Bacon, which was much later on, I think, Oh, no, actually 1200s. That's not that far away. It's only a few hundred years later. End of the 1200s. It was a head made of brass or bronze that was half mechanical, half magical.
It's a golem.
Yeah. And you can ask it any question and it would talk and tell you anything. Sometimes it was said to be limited to yes or no answers. But other times, it would just speak.
Have a conversation with a big brass head.
It was associated with this, you know, with alchemy, right? So the master alchemists might create a brass head, which I guess now it's just like ChatGPT, right? They just have like a head, like how I have the skull of Ryan. I'm not going to explain that. The skull of Ryan on my table here. How cool is that? Imagine you are a master alchemist.
Well, you got the mechanical part down with you could just put an Arduino in there. You just need to learn how to do magic.
Well, I could learn from the Muslim sorcerers how to do the dark arts.
I heard it's really nice weather over there this time of year. Should definitely go.
That's so true. So I just think that's the coolest legend. That is such a cool legend. And if you were a guy that developed a legend that you had a brass head, you must have been like, you I don't know, that would be such a brag. You'd be like, yeah.
Okay, but think about this though. Then you have to back it up. You can't just be like, oh, I got this brass head. Because then you know what everyone's going to say? Can we see it?
No, because then you're just going to say, it only speaks to me. Only I can.
And they'll be like,
there's a
lottery
sect of Christianity that's developed exactly based on that principle, Nick.
Which part?
Mormonism.
That's a good point.
Good point. Joseph Smith had a brass head. So obviously there's no evidence that he had a brazen head, but he is purported to have tried to build a huge library. Like he would ask for books, classics, and recent books from all over the world. He tried to collect that, but he died. So it never really turned into anything.
Unfortunate.
But on the note of kind of tricking trying to trick the devil or, you know, succeeding or not succeeding. According to the legends, either the demon that he made a pact with, which was supposedly called Meridiana, or the brass head he had created, told him that if he should ever perform or celebrate mass in Jerusalem, the devil would come for him. Now, he had a pilgrimage scheduled for Jerusalem at the time, and of course he canceled it, wanting to play it safe. However, of course, this is what happens when you make deals with the devil. In Rome, there was a church called the Santa Croce in Gerusalemme. Definitely butchering that, which translates to Holy Cross of Jerusalem. Not making the connection, he performed mass there in Rome and became sick soon afterwards and died. You could say he performed mass in Jerusalem in the church because the church was named Jerusalem.
I guess so.
So, you know, he thought he'd get the better of the devil, but he didn't look at the fine print. I guess you could say the devil's in the details.
Devil is in the details.
So, another variation of that story, which I think is bizarre and doesn't make any sense if you think about it for 2 seconds. Supposedly, he was even attacked by the devil while he was reading that mass. And the devil mutilated him and gave his gouged out eyes to demons to play with in the church.
Just wait.
Okay, so right, his eyes are ripped out while everyone's like, what's going on? Repenting, thankfully, he then cut off his hand and his tongue.
He did it to himself.
Yes. Can you just picture that?
Is that?
Well, I cannot.
I can picture him having a tough time continuing the mass.
Yeah, I could picture. Yeah, I don't understand how he would be able to cut off his hand and tongue with his eyes gone. Like he's like screaming, the demons are like playing like catch, and he's like, taking a knife to his tongue.
Yeah,
he's like,
hold up. Knife.
So I don't know about that variation of the legend, but
that there's just so many unanswered questions. Like, could the people see the devil? Because like this guy definitely couldn't see them tossing the eyeballs back and forth.
Maybe he could still see through the eyes, like, you know, like,
oh, that would be weird.
That would be very weird. But that's the legend of Pope Sylvester II, aka Gerbert. So I guess the lesson of that story is, if you're super smart, people will come up with reasons for why you're smart. They'll be like, nah, can't be. No way he studied.
But it's also, the devil. If you're smart, there's always someone smarter than you.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. That person's smarter than you.
Take that, Aaron Albert Rears. Einstein.
Yeah. So those are the historical, just packs of the devil stories. And we'll finish up now with just a few musical stories. I want to stop here and ask you guys, why do you think we associate music with the devil?
What comes to mind? I don't know why we do it. I just know that it has its roots in, I think, like the blues in the South. Specifically in like the, you know, 1800s, 1900s, like whatever. I don't know why, but there was a black musician and he really wanted to make it big playing the blues. And then he went to a crossroads, made it a deal. And that's where it all started.
Indeed. And we will hear that tale, actually.
And Jimmy Page.
Yes, and Jimmy Page.
Allegedly.
Frank, to kind of answer your question, music is kind of like a one thing that sets humans apart from almost all other life, I'm sure, is we are able to create music and enjoy and appreciate music. So why wouldn't you want to, you know, be the best at being human? And I can see Frank typing, writing down for his third iteration of the presentation about whether or not monkeys have culture.
No, I just immediately thought of a bird, but no, you're right.
Okay. So like, why wouldn't you want to be the best or prove you're the best at something that like is the quintessence of humanity?
And you think the devil would just be drawn to that, since you're saying like people are so drawn to that, and therefore it's like just something that is that would be easy to be used or manipulated by the devil?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of cultural things. Like, I'm sure there's, I mean, it's probably not as interesting because not as many people connect to it, but I'm sure there was like writers and stuff that turned towards the devil to, you know, maybe make it big and have like this one great story they wrote.
Oh, or, yeah.
Who knows? Maybe Shakespeare turned towards
the devil. A lot of writers claim that their best stuff comes in the form of automatic writing, where they are like semi-conscious.
Well, that's not necessarily channeling the devil.
No.
It could be anything.
But yeah, it is like a third party, if you will.
Yeah. That's what Homer did.
Potentially.
No, potentially. Simpson.
Oh. Okay. I thought you meant are you, is that an episode or something?
Probably. If anyone,
that's true.
Simpsons, anyone on Fox, you're listening, have Homer do automatic writing of the Iliad.
Do they still do you think they've ever made,
I think I'm going to write a Shakespeare play.
So, wait, do you think they've ever made a Homer joke being the author?
Oh, I'm sure.
They've got that, right?
In what, 30 plus years?
If we're the first people to do that and they make an episode, we get all of the revenue.
Yeah, I get the royalties. Look at that, sponsor us.
Yep. Oh my God. I don't know if we want to be on Fox News.
Yeah, right.
Emerge.
That's
Emerge. There's a new podcast.
So, Aaron, that's a really good, really, really good point, I think. And I think that points to why people might be swayed by it, and why people might want to make deals with the devil, right? But still the question remains of, is there something connecting the devil himself to music? Well, I got a little deep into this one, and I thought there was something very, very clear cut, like some biblical source that goes all the way back. That's like, he was the angel that was the prettiest and the strongest and also the most amazing musician.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see it. I can't really find it. So I'm going to go into the two biblical sources that people point to. And you guys tell me whether you're convinced or not, because this really is the reason why we associate the devil with music. It's kind of the background. So, like I said, it's pretty entrenched in folklore. And as far as I know, there's one verse in Ezekiel chapter 28 and says somewhat better connection in like Isaiah chapter 14. But in Ezekiel 28, right, this is Old Testament stuff. The prophet Ezekiel, he's writing this whole rant against the king of Tyre, who is a historical person at the time and an enemy of the Israelites. And it's not clear which king he was talking about at the time that it was written. But it starts off very, very concrete. You know, like, you think you're so great. My God is better. We're better than you. Shut up, whatever. But it gets very abstract towards the end. And he seems to start comparing the king of Tyre to a more metaphysical figure. Like, he starts saying stuff about the king that can't be true of a normal human. And the early church fathers, right? So those are the people who, in like the, I don't know, I want to say like between 100 and 500 AD, were like the geniuses that argued about the right interpretations of the super early stuff and kind of set the stage for all of Christian understanding, right? So they point out that this metaphysical person that the prophet Ezekiel is comparing the king of Tyre to is probably the devil. And it connects the fall of the king because of his pride and hubris with the fall of the devil. So I'm going to quick read this in the King James Version. Chapter 28, verses 11 to 13. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyre, and say unto him, Thus saith the Lord, thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. And here's the part we care about. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle, and gold, the workmanship of thy tabrets and of thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. Wast is the word used. I've never heard that. So in the very end there, tabrets and pipes, tabrets are like small drums that pipe players used to use. From that one line, the people made the connection that the devil was a musician, because that line that's talking about the king is also talking about the devil. And it mentions that he had pipes and drums. What? I was like, what? This is the connection there? And not only that, turns out the translations for those words, tabrets and pipes, drums and pipes, in other translations, it doesn't even use those words. It uses completely different words for that. In the NABRE, which is a Catholic translation, it just says their mounts and settings were wrought in gold. So mounts and settings instead of drums and pipes. It's like completely different words.
Yeah, mounts and settings sound just like stuff you'd have on horses.
Yeah, it's like other horses or like on clothing.
Yeah,
like all these gems on clothing,
like really supposedly opulent stuff.
Exactly, he's talking about a king falling, losing because of his pride. So that was interpreted as like the wearing of jewels.
Mm-hmm.
It was a thing he did back then. Supposedly, that was depicting Lucifer, aka before he falls, originally as a high priest ministering before God. So the connection to the devil might be true, but like the music part, it's not there. It's not there.
I feel like it's a bad translation, because you were saying about all those like gems and you listed
it's weird to
half a dozen gems, and then you're like, and by the way, drums and stuff.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. And
also, what? I mean, it's the King James Version. Isn't that like,
they just made stuff up?
Yeah.
Nah, that's going to be offensive to some people. Good. No. yeah. I mean, the King James Version is certainly not the most accurate and well-researched translation. It was like the standard, and it still is for a lot of denominations, but it's not the most, if you go to the earliest translations, the earliest texts of the Old Testament, and you translate those words, it's not clear to translate them as musical instruments. Mm-hmm. But there's a better one. Isaiah 14, again, insulting another king, a different prophet insulting the king of Babylon, Isaiah. We also don't know who the heck he was talking about.
It was Nebuchadnezzar II.
It very well could have been.
Thank you for pronouncing it correctly.
But is that
But in the middle of his rant, again, so a lot of these old prophets would just rant about other kings. This one makes more sense to me. Down to Sheol, your pomp is brought, the sound of your harps. Maggots are the couch beneath you, worms your blanket. How you have fallen from the heavens, O morning star, aka Lucifer. That's what that word translates to. Son of the dawn. How you have been cut down to the earth, you who conquered nations. And so this one is pretty clearly associated with the devil.
Is that where morning star came from? Is that the earliest?
Yes. So
I always thought that was also fanfic.
No, so the name Lucifer is not a evil or demonic name.
The Morning Star thing.
Lucifer is the translation of the Morning Star.
Oh, right. Yeah. You said that.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Dang.
So is it bad? This is a little tangent, but is it bad that I expected those verses to rhyme? Because it sounded like a real diss track against those kings. So, and I'm just like,
we could make it rhyme.
Make that connection.
So are you saying that Isaiah is Kendrick and the devil is Drake?
Yes.
Exactly.
Well,
I mean,
well,
I'm not saying it.
We're not taking sides.
I'm not saying anything. I barely know what's going on with that. But
I think everyone's against Drake, so that
means
we should be against Drake.
Podcast to talk about R&B drama.
There's enough podcasts about it. But yeah, so I mean, this one directly like has a connection to the devil, according to the church fathers, because that line, "O morning star, son of the dawn, how you have been cut down to the earth."
Mm-hmm.
This one, Jesus, thousands of years later in the New Testament, is quoted as saying in Luke chapter 10, verse 18, "I have observed Satan fall like lightning from the sky." And so that was connected to the Isaiah verse about, "O morning star, son of dawn, falling down," which right above it says, "Your pomp is brought the sound of your harps." He plays the harp. Not the strongest connection though, right? It's,
I mean, I feel like
pretty surprising to me.
So a lot of angels, at least from my understanding, a lot of people associate angels with like playing harps and like little like
yeah, I wonder why
like cherubs, cherubs and stuff.
Well, I wonder if that's related.
There's
at all.
Only one of the big kahunas who also may play an instrument, and that's Gabriel in his horn.
Oh, yes.
I
yes.
know there are the, you know, trumpets or the whatever in Revelation, but
I'm sure it comes from that too, from Revelation.
Gabriel and his horn.
It's interesting to know, like, with all that stuff, where's the line? Like, what's the cutoff where, what are from biblical sources and what are from, like, extra biblical, like,
apocryphal.
Fan fiction? Like, yeah, apocryphal.
Well, apocryphal is not fanfic, but.
Yeah, yeah. Apocryphal is just like, yeah, so, we don't accept this. But, like, I mean, like, what's the stuff where we get it from, like, Paradise Lost or Dante's Inferno, where.
Oh, true.
It came much later on.
Yeah. I'm wondering if all these musical instruments are coming from like the later texts, like you mentioned, because what I don't then quite get is like, are there musical instruments just like in heaven? And then like, God's like, yo, the humans need some of that. Or was it like the humans created it? And God's like, hey, let me get some of those.
God was That's like, a good point. We need a jazz band.
Like, yeah, which game likes jazz?
Well, people thought jazz was of the devil.
That's true.
Well, people think a lot of things are of the devil because they don't agree with it and don't understand it.
Yes, yes. Well, much, much later on, this one is much more interesting, I think. This is really cool. You should listen to this piece of music. I was listening to this and all the other pieces of music we're going to talk about in a minute as I was writing these notes. So, those are the biblical sources, but there are still some personal encounters, supposedly, from the Los Angeles Philharmonic's website.
Ironic.
They talk about, yes, very. They talk about the Baroque era Italian composer and violinist Giuseppe Tartini. Have you heard of him? I hadn't heard of him.
Nope.
Well, he wrote, "One night in the year 1713, I dreamed I had made a pact with the devil for my soul. Everything went as I wished. My new servant anticipated my every desire. Among other things, I gave him my violin to see if he could play. How great was my astonishment on hearing a sonata so wonderful and so beautiful, played with such great art and intelligence as I had never even conceived in my boldest flights of fantasy. I felt enraptured, transported, enchanted. My breath failed me, and I awoke. I immediately grasped my violin in order to retain, in part at least, the impression of my dream. In vain. The music which I at this time compose is indeed the best that I ever wrote, and I still call it the Devil's Trill. But the difference between it and that which so moved me is so great that I would have destroyed my instrument and have said farewell to music forever. If it had been possible for me to live without the enjoyment it affords me. So
I have heard of the Devil's Trill, but I like
this is the story behind the Devil's Trill Sonata. It's known for being an extremely technically difficult piece to play.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of crazy that he claims it came to him in a dream. From the devil. Where have we heard that before? I mean, you hear stories of that all the time.
Nikola Tesla. Oh, sorry.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right. Different intellectuals, artists claim to receive information in dreams or visions. Tesla, all of his stuff.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. People don't really know that. Look into that. We should do episode on Tesla. That'd be cool.
That's for Aaron.
Aaron, you should do that.
I feel like that'd be pretty cool. I mean, it's not really supernatural.
Oh, there's a lot of occult stuff around Tesla.
There's a lot of stuff.
Oh, boy.
But anyway.
Well, maybe I'll have to look into
it. It's a common thing where artists not now. I would say it happens way more than we think. And people just don't go around saying, hey, everyone, this idea, it wasn't mine. It was the devil's.
That's a weird way to reference a ghostwriter.
Right, exactly. The OG ghostwriter. That's funny. Wait, I'm gonna use that as like the episode title or something.
Ghostwriter or something.
Yeah. But yeah, so I don't know. I feel like you wouldn't want to make that up because it doesn't really paint you in the best light. And there have been other musicians who there's another violinist that people said played so violently and wore all black, people would claim to see the devil on stage playing with him as he played. Mm. Roughly the same time period as this guy. And that's kind of the precedent for music and the devil. There's some here. Implying he's a super talented musician. But I was surprised at how little there was, right? It seems like a lot of it was kind of more developed, as you were saying, Nick, like by musicians in the last century or so.
Yep.
Like with rock and roll and people thinking it's the music of the devil and all that stuff. So I'll finish now with the story of Robert Johnson. So we'll finish with the story of Robert Johnson, which Nick, you actually alluded to. He is the blues singer that supposedly made a deal with the devil at a crossroads. Well, he's one of the two, which we'll touch on. But I want to first touch on what Aaron said way back about a kind of music separating us from the animals. I mean, what better field than music has people so interested in fame and fortune and glory at the expense of everything else sometimes, right? Including relationships and health. Mm-hmm. How common is that? I mean, few other things come to mind, like, I don't know, business stuff, like finance, entrepreneurs, banking, finance.
Acting, right? Actors.
Yeah, acting, right? Yeah. It's like the stuff that brings you fame and glory. Power and money.
Well, it's the feast or famine kind of things.
Yeah. So I think it makes sense why we hear so many stories of musicians who would do anything to rise above their peers, turn to dark forces. So Robert Johnson was an early traveling blues singer and guitarist who lived from 1911 to 1938. I cannot imagine living in that time period. It's like a really weird time, mm-hmm. especially given that he was black and he was born into a terribly poor sharecropping family in Mississippi.
Yeah, not great.
I could think of some other decades that are worse, but like this is also probably a really bad time.
Well, yeah, anything before the Civil War.
Yeah, anything before.
But still, but not given good. Like,
yeah, not good. Not good. And he wasn't really known for being a super hard worker when he was young. He was always playing music. And unfortunately, when he grew up a bit, he tragically lost a wife and baby during childbirth, who he really loved. And it kind of sent him into a depression. And he started traveling around the South, hitting different juke joints, which are just clubs back in the day.
Speakeasies.
Yeah, right. Speakeasies.
I don't know if they were metropolized enough to call it a speakeasy.
Yeah, I don't think these. It was mostly for like black, like it was like a cultural. It was a place where lots of the early blues musicians kind of came up, where they would play and practice. And he would go there and he would travel around with his musical idols, Son House and Willie Brown. And it's pretty funny because supposedly at the time, at this point in his life, he was so bad on the guitar. He would go up after Son House and Willie Brown, who were quite good, would finish their sets. He would go up and he'd be booed off the stage. They'd beg him to stop playing. Like, it was that bad. Like, he'd go up there, he'd trumpet, and they'd be like, who is this kid? Get, please, please stop. Then he disappeared. And the legend has it, 18 months later, he reappeared at a club near his hometown in Mississippi. And he wasn't the same old kid playing terribly on his guitar. He stunned both the audience and other guitarists that knew him and had played with him and had heard him. He's said to have made his 7-string guitar, and he had added another string to his, you know, 6-string guitar. He made it sound like an entire band, and he played the guitar with new techniques no one had ever seen before. He was suddenly a master. And on top of that, he developed a eerie sort of, I don't know if the technical term is voicing, but just his vocals, a really eerie sort of moaning, you know, blues style voice for his songs. And all of a sudden he becomes a hit. And from this, he goes on to become the founding father of modern blues, and is even considered to this day the grandfather of rock and roll. But at the time, musicians and listeners alike, they couldn't help but wonder, what happened? Where did he go? And what happened to him to gain such musical talent? What caused that 180 reversal? And so, of course, the legend developed that one night in Mississippi, Clarksdale, Mississippi, to be exact, he had stumbled across a dark man at some intersection. And it's not known what crossroads it was. Different towns claim, right? Yeah, we were the town that had the crossroads, or the crossroads were, you know, Route 20 and Route 17. It was right here, but it's not known. But it said that Johnson handed the man his guitar, who tuned it, played a few songs, and handed it back. And so, of course, it said that he made a deal with the devil, selling his soul in return for musical talent and technique the world had never before seen, or at least that part of the world. And now, he never denied the story, and he kind of leaned into it. He was like, okay, I can see, you know. Yeah. He released songs like Hellhound on My Trail and Crossroad Blues. I really encourage you to listen to these. So these were recorded in, like, I want to say the 30s or the 20s.
It's almost 100 years old.
And his lyrics, here's a quote from one of my sources, quote, his lyrics oozed with references to walking alongside evil and hoodoo references linked to lore of old African magic. And my understanding of hoodoo is that it was an Americanized form of voodoo that was brought to like the Mississippi region in that part.
Louisiana. Yep.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah, that's what they said in Princess and the Frog.
Oh, you're probably right. Yeah, the guy who's got friends on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's actually about this guy.
Oh my goodness.
Robert or Johnson.
Honestly, well, unfortunately, as always, deals with the devil take their toll, and he went on to lose another wife and child. Not to death, thankfully, but he got kicked out, rejected by the family, and had to leave them. And again, descended into vice and alcoholism, and died at the ripe old age of, take a wild guess,
24.
Well, you said he was born in 1911 and then died.
No, don't, just think. Musician, he sold his soul to the devil. What age did he die?
25. Even though I can do basic math. 27.
He's one of the people that are the root of the 27 club myth. You guys know about that?
Yeah.
I couldn't remember what the number was, but yes, I know.
Yeah, he's one of the very first musicians that people point to.
Whoa.
As having died at age 27. How crazy is that?
Wait.
And legend.
I wonder if
go ahead.
I wonder if the devil was like, you know, because you really screwed up and I'm going to ruin it for the rest of the musicians because.
Yeah, right. It is uncanny. I mean, you know, that's a good age to die. So I get it. Right.
Yeah, sure.
Is it a good age to die?
I mean, like physically, aren't you going to start decreasing from around there? Like.
27? You think you're peaking at 27?
See, I peaked at 27 months old.
It's all been downhill. It's all been downhill
from there. But legend has it, you know, again, he didn't just go to sleep and die. He was poisoned by the husband of a woman he was messing around with.
Well, I mean.
So it was said. And most of this guy's life is shrouded in mystery. There are like two confirmed pictures of him in existence.
No.
It's not known where he was buried. There are at least three different places that people have erected markers or gravestones saying this could be a place where Robert Johnson, father of the blues and grandfather of rock and roll, is buried. But there's not a lot known. And because of that, it's kind of added to the mystique and the legend behind him. And if you're interested more in his story, because there's a lot more, and you should really listen to the songs. I'm going to have a lot of them in the show notes. They were republished in the 50s by the record label, and they went on to inspire rock musicians, like the early rock musicians. He was kind of forgotten about, and when they republished him after his death decades later, I should have the list here of who he inspired, but like a lot of people are like, wow, that's pretty cool. If you're interested in learning more, there's a Netflix documentary, Remastered, Devil at the Crossroads, which goes deeper into the tale. I'll finish with this question, which I'll touch on and pose to you guys. Crossroads. So we talked about, you know, deals and the connection with music, but crossroads. What is it about crossroads? So many cultures have tales of mystical, spiritual, paranormal encounters, the connections between paths, right? It's kind of all across the world, all across time. What do you think it is?
I don't know, because it's not like, oh, well, nature kind of made these crossroads. Like, we made the crossroads. So I was trying to think, like, is it like where the veil between our reality and the supernatural reality is the thinnest, or is it like something like that? But we made the crossroads.
Doesn't that support? I mean, I don't know. Obviously, I don't know the answer to this, but I think I agree with what you're saying, right? These aren't random, right? Crossroads aren't random locations in the world.
True.
They are think of it this way, right? How many roads in especially places that have much more history, like say Europe instead of the Americas, but roads, paved roads, they when people paved roads, they didn't see footpaths that were used and go, oh, cool. Well, let's make a road like right here for fun. Roads that are used today are very often paths that have been traveled on by people for thousands, if not in places in the world, tens of thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
What else in the human world is like that? Buildings don't last that long, right? Other land gets used and reused and torn down and used in different ways. Water changes, like water is never the same. I don't know, you know, like even rivers change direction, but like paths. How many of the paths around the corner from me on this little island I'm on, like, were walked on by Native Americans for thousands of years before me? So I do think, Aaron, you're right. Because of the human connection, because of the foot traffic, it is maybe a place that's thin, right? It's the intersection of two places. And there's something about that.
Do you think we subconsciously did that over history and then, you know, just so happened?
I remember that certainly reading about how it pretty much you can take a road and trace back its history really, really far. Like in general, humanity like reuses pathways, reuses roads. Half, obviously, we'll think of it this way, like, half is subconscious, but also like economical and like
commerce.
It's efficient, right? It's not efficient to keep recreating roads. Like, so I think naturally and purposefully, roads are reused and have so much human energy built up over millennia. So yeah, I don't know what that means, what that does, but I think that has a big part in this. Yeah. It's something to think about. Something to think about for sure. Maybe we can do future episodes on those sorts of liminal spaces.
Oh, yeah.
Spaces between spaces. You could say a crossroad is kind of like that, right? People going different ways, meeting each other.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any place in the world to run into a spirit or, you know, good or bad, I think it would make sense that it's on a road, and especially a crossroad. You would come across someone offering to tune your guitar for the small fee of your eternal soul. So with that, we'll end here. Thank you for listening to season 2, episode 2. All my references and some of the links to Robert Johnson's music and The Devil's Trill are in the show notes. I encourage you to play them on Spotify. Honestly, leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen. And a word of advice from the gentleman at Wednesday at 9 p.m. Don't go around making deals with the devil now. Good night.